Barry Teicher of the UW History Project. I'm here in the Humanities Building with Mr. Norris Wentworth. Mr. Wentworth, could you briefly summarize your undergraduate experience and your graduate training here at UW?
I majored in animal husbandry and genetics, a double major. My first year, I lived with Professor Gus Bosted. The other 3 years, I lived in the genetics barn, taking care of my project, which was hybridizing, crossbreeding doves and pigeons, ringneck doves and pigeons. And one reason I lived in the barn. I left that after I graduated. There were no jobs, and I wasn't accepted in the university for graduate work where I had applied. So I got a job. Job appeared as an assistant minister in a congregational church in Davenport, Iowa. I'd been active in the Congregational Student Association here. So I spent a year there and then went for 5 years in the congregational student work at Iowa State College. Came back here in 30 for rural sociology, and we didn't match. And I was appointed to a fellowship in 31 in the dormitories, and I stayed in that area.
How did you go about getting appointed to the fellowship in 31?
I'm sorry, I cannot remember how I applied or who interviewed me or anything. I just remember making the job.
Okay. Before we get into your first year as a fellow at Vilas, you said back in your undergraduate training on your project, which was the doves and the pigeons.
Yeah.
Did every student have a project?
Major in genetics had a project.
Sort of like a senior thesis?
Yeah. This is my thesis. Matter of fact, I brought it back here 3 weeks ago for the genetics department. Had a lot of pictures. Yes, in the agriculture, you had a thesis or you wrote a big paper.
How long did that continue?
No.
Okay, but getting back to the major emphasis on this interview, which is your experiences from 1931 to 1941 working for housing. So start by describing your job functions in your first year as a fellow at Vilas.
Don Halverson was the director. The head fellow that year was either Red Erdman or Norman Neal. I think it was not Norman Neal because I moved into Vilas House and he had been in Vilas House. So I think it was probably Herbert Erdman. And how I got in, I don't know. I'm sorry. But immediately, the boys had a feeling that I was kind of religious, which I never have been. I didn't use vile language, and I used this broad A, which I inherited from New England, and they thought I was queer. But we got along. There were only the 32 boys in the house, and they were a fine bunch of boys. There were two or three that liked to try things out, but it was normal. And we really had very little trouble. I was responsible for the library because it was in the basement of Vilas House. Norman Neal had built up quite a fine library in just the 2 or 3 years he was there. George Chandler, I believe, started it. George Chandler is the basis for so many things in the fellowship program, starting in 26. But we didn't have trouble. The boys, we had more non-freshmen in the Vilas House at that time than we did later on when we made quotas. After about 34, we made quotas so that we'd be sure to have 50% freshmen in all of the houses. But no, the first year they began making fun of me. I enjoyed it. I took it with a grain of salt, and so the first year I remember very little.
Let me see if I can drag a memory a little bit. What kind of training did you have for your position that first year, in service or whatever orientation?
Only in the charge of the congregational student work at Iowa State. Understand the student attitudes and so forth.
Did Don Halverson do anything? Did he have any sessions or anything?
No, but I used to talk to Dean Goodnight mm-hmm. when there was a question that I had, and the junior dean, Jewish name,
Glicksman.
Yeah. I talked with him a good deal, especially after this first year, because we did get more and more undergraduates, junior students. But no, I had no, they just said, there are three rules, no women, no pets, no liquor. And just see to it that they obey, observe their quiet hours, and that they're reasonable gentlemen all the time. And that's what we did, and there was no trouble.
Yes, you were not a graduate student at the time. You were just employed as a fellow?
Yeah, but that they made an exception. I was enrolled 1 year. I took a course or two. I think probably that first year, but after that, I wasn't taking any course.
So you were just employed by Howling to be a fellow. Were most other fellows graduate students?
Oh, yes. Graduate students, law students, or medical students, which would be graduate.
What did you see, you hinted on this just a moment ago, but let's put it in a specific category. What did you see as your job responsibilities as head fellow?
Oh, beyond the rules. Mm-hmm. Just gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Just conduct themselves so they wouldn't be ashamed of what they had done. I guess you could say it that way. We didn't have rules. We really, those three rules is what we stuck to.
No pets, no liquor.
No women.
No. Easy enough to remember.
Yeah.
Were you aware early on, and now I realize the years may just sort of merge together a little bit here, but that's okay. Were you aware of any philosophy of house fellows? System of house fellows?
Oh, I don't think so. That's hard to say because we knew that we were supposed to keep the boys not in line really, but to understand that they were living in a group and that they had to take, be aware of that fact. And when there were little difficulties, I remember one boy in Frankenberger, while I was still in Vilas, the boys picked on him like everything. He was a weak Jewish boy and very retiring, and they would tease him unmercifully. So I went with the fellow, and we took three or four of the boys into the fellow's suite, and we talked it over and said to leave him alone. If they didn't care for him, just that didn't make any difference, just see that he isn't picked on, and it stopped. Another boy was very effeminate in Spooner House, and this was in the early years. He was being approached, and the fellow there and I, with two or three of the boys, talked it over, and those boys decided they would not let that boy walk down the Ox Road, the Lake Road, we called it the Ox Road, alone at night. Just to protect him. And they did it for 2-3 months, and he wasn't attacked after that, or approached, I shouldn't say attacked. It's that sort of thing that we worked on all the time. With 32 or 36, and high house was 23, you could be pretty close to the boys.
So did you spend a fair amount of time?
Oh, yes.
Do you think you were typical in that regard?
Yes. I don't think I spent any more time than others. And they were always welcome to go in to see the fellow. And I don't know of any who, there was one who'd get sharp once in a while. He was working awfully hard as a medical student. And if he were in his apartment and the boys bothered too much, he'd get to yell at them pretty loud. But normally, it wasn't any.
You would get together with students who were having problems and talk it over with them.
But there were very few.
Did any students ever come to you with problems with other house fellows, for example?
No. I have two or three letters written to me about what I did, trying to make the boys stand in line. And well, one very strong letter sending him back from the dining room because he didn't have a coat and tie, and they were supposed to have that at night. And he wrote a very strong letter. Why would I put myself up to make them go way back to get their receipt to prove, this was when they had to show that they were, this one was when they had to show that they had paid their bills in order to have their meals. But sending them back for their coats and ties, they knew perfectly well that's what they did, were to do.
This is in the early 30s.
Yes.
Right. So all of the, would all the hospitals do that?
Yes.
What about the ex-college? Did that cause a problem?
Yes, but I was in Trip Hall, you see.
Yeah.
So the, all the Adams boys, they only had, what, La Follette and the one next to it, I tried to think of it the other night. The two houses, there was Noyes and another house in La Follette. That's all the ex-college boys there were at that time. And then they closed them out. Was it spring of 32?
Yeah.
So that, yeah, well, the ex-college boys didn't have to wear coats and so forth. But so they were looked down on, as a matter of fact. They weren't being admired.
Let's get to the coats and ties a little further ahead of time. Now, you were there from 1941. Did that regulation, coats and ties, for dinner, that pretty much...
I don't think it stopped.
So,
but there was an way around it that developed, 35 or 6. They could go in the late dining room, which was on the back side of the refectory, where only the workers and the people, the athletes and so forth, who couldn't get there for 6 o'clock were supposed to eat. So a boy that didn't want to clean up or got there late, he'd go in there. Nobody raised any questions.
Let's look at a typical meal early on in 31, 32.
Yeah.
A young man comes into the dining area. What size are the tables? How many people sit? I just want to know all about what it looked like in there.
We had two tables, 32 boys. I had that, read that somewhere. Each table had 16 with an end table, end place. The head, the fellow, sat at the end of one of those tables. And for at least the first year, first 2 years, 31, 32, 32, 33, we assigned places in a lot of the houses in Tripp. I don't know what they did in Adams very much. And moved them around so that the one small group wouldn't stick together. We had quite a bit of, not trouble, but there'd be people come over from Extension as juniors, Extension at Milwaukee. And they would tend to stick together if you gave them a chance. Matter of fact, I met two. And they said, I remember we had trouble. I met two 3 weeks ago. But generally speaking, the dining hall procedure was similar. The head fellow, they all waited standing up on Sunday noon until the head fellow, they sang a varsity. We sat down. I cannot be sure whether, but what we did that every night except Saturday night. Saturday night was informal.
Stand up and sing varsity?
And we'd at least wait until the head fellow came, or if the head fellow wasn't there, they knew perfectly well who was the one to give the signal to sit down.
Now, the head fellow differed from the other fellows in that he was head for that whole house.
The whole
did he have a
hall.
Ring, 32 boys just like everyone else?
Oh, yes. He had the same responsibility.
Elected to that position?
No, he was appointed by the dormitory committee.
Okay, now we're back to
I hope you have something on that dormitory committee sometime.
Well, we will get to it, but I'll write that down right now. So
because that was a very strong committee.
Okay, we'll cover that in a little bit.
Yeah.
The food was served?
Yes.
By waiters?
Waiters, correct. Which meant that the 16 places were not always filled because so many of the boys earned most or all of their meals by serving. Mm-hmm. Waiters and working in the kitchen and the serving line.
Was it farm style? Was that it? You passed the things around? Or?
No, well, you were not supposed to. The fellow was supposed to, the head of the table was supposed to serve them all. The plates were put there, and of course sometimes they'd get reckless and pass
so
the plates up.
And
it was fairly formal.
What about were prayers at home?
I don't think so. That's awful to say, but I don't think we ever did.
So we have the meal. What kind of, were manners stressed during the meal?
Oh, you can make a small remark sometime when things get too bad. We had Canadians who spit the watermelon seeds in the summer. And we had a real time with them because they were as old as I. And they had did it for fun. And, of course, everybody else would do it. So they quit serving watermelon.
Pretty effective way to do it.
Yeah.
What kind of, as a house fellow, what about mealtime conversation? Did you stress that? Did you just let it flow the way it was?
Well, I think we always let it flow because they talk about university activities and they get arguing in Vilas House, for example.
We're obviously in a classroom. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, in Vilas House we had a lot of engineers and they'd get to arguing about their courses and problems that they were in mathematics and so forth and really have a time about it. Mm-hmm. And somebody would had already had it. No, I don't think we ever really...
What's the conversation? What if they started talking about girls or something?
They didn't much in those days.
So it was mainly about the classroom?
Yeah, and activity. We had a big athletic program, and they played basketball in the winter, and touch football in the fall, and touch foot baseball softball in the spring. And we'd get within the hall, the eight teams would play, and then we'd play against the other hall and so on.
So it'd be around Robin's head.
Yeah.
How did what was going on in Crippen Adams differ from what was going on in the girls' dorms on campus?
For one thing, there was much less control. Well, in those days, the girls were controlled very closely. Certain ones had to be in at 8 o'clock unless they had permission. Everybody had to be in 10:30 and that sort of thing. Well, we didn't have anything like that. Our rules were only quiet hours from 7:30 on.
So the students could stay up till 2 in the morning if they wanted to?
Yeah. It's the boys.
The boys, right.
Yeah. Doors were never locked. Never. No, and we had an excellent night watchman. I hope you've heard about John.
No, tell me about John. Let's get him on tape.
I can't say his last name at the moment, John. Anyway, he was a Swiss. And heavy set, fairly short, spoke broken English, he spoke with a Swiss accent. But he got along with the boys, and he would tell them what to do. The boys would come in, some of them would get too much to drink. We had two boys in Vilas, and once or twice his fellow floor members would take him in and give him a cold shower, but it was nothing serious at all. But then John Hammersley, Hammersley, or L-Y, I'm not sure which. He was there every night. I don't think he had any night off in those days. He'd come on at 9 or 10 and stay till 6 in the morning. And if there was noise, and it was still 10 o'clock or so, he would sometimes yell quiet hours. If it was later, he'd go into the house and tell the boys to be quiet if the fellow wasn't around. He used to come up and talk to me if there was something special that he didn't like. And he'd come around midnight. But no rules, really. They just said, well, John won't like that. It was a personality that controlled it.
Was he related to Joe Hammersley by any chance?
I don't know.
Legend of his own.
Yeah, I'm not sure that he wasn't. He had two or three sons.
So, were there any other people like John in the home, in the house, cooks or anyone like that who had that?
Well, everybody enjoyed the chef.
Is that
Carson Gully. He was very friendly. And he'd be out talking to the boys, or they'd talk to him in the kitchen and serving them and so forth. He was very popular. He was a fine man. And there was another man, Einar Anderson, who was in charge of the maintenance, who got along pretty well with the boys.
Was Carson, how was the food?
The food was excellent.
Beulah
Daly was the dietitian, and we had good cooks who had been there from the beginning or had been transferred from women's halls when this one opened up. There was never any complaint about the food except as you would institutional. We ate rye bread. I'll never forget the amount of rye bread those boys ate. That was baked in the kitchen over at Lathrop.
Is that the staple bread that they was?
Yeah, they ate a lot more rye bread than white.
Were there any dishes that were well known that the boys would say, you know, or that had become traditional or anything like that? Besides, we have the rye bread as one.
Yeah.
Is something that was not real famous.
Yeah, there were, but I can't say what they were at the moment. We always had a very nice Thanksgiving dinner. I think it was turkey. Because in those days we had only the one day.
Now,
I can't say
as a fellow at BIOS, and in the second and third years of your stay at UWWBM, 32 and 33, was there much, did the fellows get together much?
Yes.
Socially or?
Once a week, we went down to the union for dinner. I think it was once a week. And we'd have all 16.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was anything, any problem, Don Halverson was usually there, if not always. And sometimes it was just plain social, but it was to get away. And the boys knew it. Never anything that untoward happened while the fellows were gone.
Nothing that you knew about.
No, and then the president of the house would preside at the table. But, well, we could have cut out our meetings, but we ate in the Beefeater's room. There's a beautiful old room. They've changed it a good deal since. I was in there once 4 or 5 years ago. But it used to be very English. No, the fellows were pretty close. And then we usually had something before or between Christmas and the end of the semester. We'd go out for a night on the town. Went to a place over on the other side and always had some of them drank beer and some of us didn't. And I must tell you one thing, we went out once to a place on Lake Monona that was a famous nightclub. Way back when a woman ran it. And we came in where I think most of us were in the group. And the hostess kind of questioned, then she said, "Oh, Mr. Wentworth's with you. That it'll be all right." I had no idea who she was. And I had never been there. But no, they were gentlemen. That's one of the things the committee looked for. Who they had a reasonable understanding of what gentlemanly acts were.
Okay, I got a few more questions. Then we're going to get that darn committee all still fresh on my mind. As head fellow, did you have any special access to Mr. Halverson?
No more than any of the others, but because whenever he was there in the office, if he wasn't busy with somebody else, there was no question about getting in. He would come in 8:30 or so in the morning, having stopped at Barnard, the kitchen, and the business office was there, the supply office, food service office was there. He would have cleared up things there and then come over to his office in the union. And there was no question.
What additional responsibilities did being the head fellow have?
Oh, he was somebody you could turn to if things weren't going or if they wanted to get everybody to know about it. It was easier to tell the head fellow and then he'd pass it on to the fellows of the houses. Yeah, really. I think that.
Did you have fellows come to you during that time?
Oh, every once in a while, they'd come and say, "What am I going to do with so and so?"
What might be a typical concern? Make one up or draw on
it? Well, John Dinkeldine lived in Bashford Hall House, And he would not study. He would not take showers. He just wouldn't do anything he was supposed to, and he wasn't very bright anyway. And we fussed with him for most of the first semester. And again, we got the boys on that floor to tell John, go and study, and you stay there in your room until 10:30. Or they'd tell John, go and take a shower, put on some clean clothes. Well, by the end of the second year, he was a different boy. The other boys took care of him. Yeah, peer. Yeah, that's the new term.
Tell me about the different, well, let's go to the dorm committee first, then we'll get to the different student committees. We're going to talk about committees now.
All right.
Tell me what you can about the dorm committee.
I don't know what the earliest reason for it was, but there was Dr. Hal Bradley in physiology, physical, I don't know, Otto Kowalki, engineering, Scott Goodnight, dean, Porter Butts, Don Halverson, and I think that's all.
Yeah, there might have been one more person for a while, but I can't think of the name either. Porter Butts came in, I think, a little later, so about 28.
Oh. Well, you see, this is, I think that's right. I'm talking about 31.
Yeah, right.
When I got into
right,
it.
When you got into it.
Yeah. I don't know what really happened. But every one of those men was a very strong personality, knew what manners should be, customs should be, and they did have some problems, but one of the big things they did was choose fellows. Candidates would be presented to them, and we'd have week after day after day of interviews.
Tell me how long those interviews would go.
Well, Otto Kowalki was the good one to start them off. He'd say, what do you think of something in the neighborhood? One, he used to get them on at Green Bay. There's a hill at Green Bay that is pronounced in various ways, and I remember one boy, he carried him along. And the boy just didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't get anywhere because he didn't know what was going on. Or Otto Kowalki would say, what kind of tree is that out there? He'd raise up a question just to get a general idea of the boy's attitude or general knowledge. The interviews, I think we listed them for about a 30-minute interview. And they went through, asked them what they were doing in college and what they planned to do and why were they usual questions. And with the half hour, and after I got into it, I would have a preliminary meeting with them and get a lot of their personal history so they didn't have to ask, well, where did you come from? And unless they wanted to, because they'd have it on the sheet. And, we'd have 50 or more applicants for the maybe 6 or 8 positions.
So those are fairly sought after positions?
Oh, yes. And they knew they had responsibility. And they had it impressed on them in the convention, in the conference meetings. But you can't imagine doing anything but your very best in front of those 5 men. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, I just want to get the sense of how this.
They were leaders socially as well as educationally in the faculty.
Okay. And so that they would then make the decision based on these interviews. Would they have second interviews or would it just be usually one interview?
Sometimes. We had a boy come in a second time because he was too scared or something.
Again, sort of more or less summarizing what you've been saying. What do you think those 5 men were looking for, first and foremost?
Personal responsibility, his personality, he's got to be pleasant. I mean, understand that he can't growl at people and so on. General congeniality.
You've mentioned a little
with a seriousness of being in school.
You mentioned a little bit about Professor Kowalki. What about Dean Goodnight and Professor Bradley and some of the others?
Bradley was quite a leader. He would bring up educational questions. Scott Goodnight, you couldn't guess what he was going to. He was a very interesting person. If he knew anything about any activity that boy had, and sometimes we found something in their personal history, he would occasionally bring up the question, well, now, what about this? I understand so-and-so. It was never a real hard, harsh confrontation.
What other responsibilities that you know did the dorm committee have?
I think they set up women's dormitory stuff too. They set up general policies. They did not set prices, so far as I know. I never heard that they did, because they didn't change much. In the years that I was involved, I don't suppose they changed, well, $50, if that much. And part of it went down. It was mostly just the general supervision, social supervision of the dormitory. We had a long session, long in the Depression, long 34, 35, on the possibility or advisability, probably first, of building another quadrangle east of Tripp and renting that or even selling units to fraternities, because the fraternities were having a terrible time. And they had a lot of talk on that. Some of the fraternities were interested, but they didn't have money. Well, they didn't think they wanted to really rent it, so it fell through. Probably was a good thing, but...
So one of their primary responsibilities then was selecting that fellow.
Yeah, that was a very important activity.
Sort of set the ball in motion and then let it roll as much as it can on its own.
You've got to understand also that Don Halverson knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he had such an understanding that it was a question of what he did.
Was he around the dorms a lot?
No.
So
not the men's hall. Oh, he'd be out. They came out at noon for lunch, part of Carson Gully's attractiveness. We ate in the shop, soda shop, that was at the end of the refectory. I've forgotten what we called it. But it got so there'd be six or eight of us in the staff that would be there for lunch. We settled a lot of good arguments there. And Carson would come in. And Don would be out for that quite a bit. But to meet with the boys, not very much.
Let's look at any other administrative committees during this period. We had the dorm committee. Were there any other important committees dealing with housing? Was that pretty much it?
No. The student organization, but that was their own. And
yeah, that's what we're going to talk about next. Let's talk about it. The student organization, tell me about it.
Each one had the...
Each
hall had its council, but then they joined together for the Men's Dormitory Association, I think they called it. Men's Residence Hall. MRHA, yeah. Men's Residence Hall Association. They'd set up athletic schedules. I got them interested in the library, spending money for subscriptions and so forth, more than they had been. We got the store organized. And they had manager and ran the place, and they made a lot of money. And then they had a weightlifting room. They decided they'd like that, so we got one worked out. When they'd raise questions that were interest to the majority of the residents, there wasn't much question of what they'd get it.
Where did they get money for?
Well, they charged, I think they had membership dues of $3 a year or something like that. everybody that lived here.
So that was just sort of a standard idea.
Yeah, yeah. By that, they financed the library, for example. They bought some equipment for the weightlifting room, for example.
Tell me about this store. I've heard an awful lot about it. Now, you were there when it originated.
Yeah.
Tell me about it from the very first seed of an idea.
Great problem was the amount of cleaning and laundering that was picked up at the gatehouses. It became a real problem because the cleaners or launderers would pick it up and they would, and then when they delivered it, it had to be paid for. So that the gatehouse keeper was responsible for quite a bit of cash. They gave him 20% discount for taking care of it. Well, that wasn't very good for the university employee to make money off of his activity within the university activity. So we talked about what we could do, and the idea came, why don't...
Now, who's we?
More or less, but Don Halverson and the committee, some of the members of the committee, the fellows, just general conversation. We went to these cleaners and said, if we set up a store, if the boys set up a store, will you pay them the percentage for collecting your money? And they agreed. Everybody agreed but Brandebaum. We were, when we got going strong, we were buying stuff, and he didn't want to give it a discount. So we tried to, the boys tried to go somewhere else to buy it. They had quite a time. I think they finally, this was about the time he was governor. But it was settled finally, and they did a tremendous business. They weren't supposed to make money more than what their planned expenses would be, so they made rebates. In the first place, everybody that was a member would get a rebate of some kind. Then they decided that was too easy. So you kept your receipts. We bought a cash register. And they had to keep their receipts. And if they turned in their receipts, they'd get a discount on the total of those. And that went along very well. Then they decided they wanted to buy some canoes, or they decided to buy something so they wouldn't pay much of a discount at the end of the year, a rebate or whatever they called it. It was open noon. I think it was open from 12:30 to 1:30, something like that, and 5 to 6:30. They paid the boys who were clerks. They had a manager who took care of the general operation of the thing. And then they decided they'd have a barbershop. That was in the days when haircuts were 50 cents. And we got the equipment, worked it out with somebody, I've forgotten who the barber was, to set up a barbershop in an adjoining room in the basement of La Follette. And, well, it's still there.
So this is all the boys doing?
Yeah, we'd encourage them and help them along.
Now, so would this be their government association that would do all the...
Yes, yeah.
So
that's
the
store committee.
The boys who weren't on the committee would talk to their representative.
Yeah,
he would talk to them about it.
Yes, it was very much a boys' affair.
So they have things like stores, barbershops, to talk about the athletic. And what about social?
Oh, every once in a while, but I don't think they charged admission to the dances. I don't think they did. And of course, the bands or orchestras in those days didn't cost more than $150 for a 6 or 8 piece band. We had a night. Never mind. That's too long a story.
Was that a pretty? Was that the social base for most of these boys, the dorms?
For many, I don't know as I'd say most. I wouldn't say it's a majority, but for many of them, yeah, they were well attended. And there was one boy, Art Katona, who went to New York. He was quite an extreme. People accused him of being communist before communism really got going. But he was just different and out. And he learned to do the Big Apple. in New York. Oh, some kind of a chain dance. Oh, terrific thing. Well, that when they'd get Art Katona, make sure that he'd come to a dance, and when people found out he was going to be there to run the Big Apple, we had great attendance. No, we were a community by ourselves, somewhat. When what are the ones? Trip Adams and the ones on beyond.
Cronsade.
When those 600 or 800 boys came in, it did break down the closeness. Then we moved the store over to Mack House from La Follette so there would be more space.
Why did it break down the closeness?
Well, because there was so much. And they ate in a different, they ate over in the Cronsage dining hall. Well, there were 60 or more in the house, whereas over in Trip and Adams, there were only a maximum of 36, 32 is a great number.
So some of that size factor cut down.
Oh, very much, yeah. Cronsage would have a dance. I don't know whether they, I don't think they ever kept anybody out from the halls. One of the other things that was quite important in the library was the examination file. Well, it got started early, and people would turn in their questions pretty well, and it got to be, there was another boy, Jim Abajian, A-B-A-J-I-A-N. He finally went to University of Michigan. He got to be the librarian, and he went after the boys to get their questions, quiz papers in. We got a tremendous file. And people from outside the dormitories would come in to use them, take them away, and it became quite a problem. And the library committee finally said, nobody gets those questions except we must be sure they live in the dormitories.
So they were regular exam, final exams?
Oh, yeah. You brought your paper sheet of final exams, and they filed them. And they had a big file. Filed drawers of them. Yeah. it was well known that they did.
Did the house, the halls, the hall and then the house, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did the halls and or the houses ever do things as units around other parts of campus, like football games or anything like that?
I don't think they got outside the dormitory league in athletics. Mm-hmm. I don't remember that they did. Maybe they did.
No, I'm talking about like going places together.
Yeah.
Saturday afternoon or something like that.
I wouldn't say they do, but did. Okay. They did get their seats together, for example, in a football game or something like that.
One more question, then I want to move on to some of your activities as graduate. You're now a fellow or head fellow. And it's a typical, normal school day in early November. What are you going to do from morning to night? What are your responsibilities in that house?
Well, in the first place, most of them are students, graduate students. So they had their class schedule that they had to go to. Nothing at breakfast, you just be friendly. At lunch, they were supposed to be at their tables. In the afternoon, if they were around, there'd be some house activity, say an athletic event, team play, and good weather in the summer, of course, everybody would go swimming. Dinner, we'd gather, as I've told you. After dinner, they'd go back to the den, they called it, that lounge on the first floor. And we had Victrolas. We bought Victrolas, the association did. And they bought pianos for most of them. So that we'd gather in the lounge, the den, a lot of them. They'd play cards or they'd play cards up in their rooms. If they played cards in their rooms after 7:30, they better not get awful noisy about it. And they all knew that. They paid so much attention to the other people in those days. Mm-hmm. Quiet.
What about radios?
We didn't have many. And as I recall, later in the last few years, before 1941, I wasn't living. I was living over in the refectory. There were times when the radios were too loud. They'd have them in the window of Adams. And people over in Tripp would complain. Well, the only thing to do is to get a hold of the fellow or find out who's living in that room and go and tell him to shut down the radio.
Well, you had music on the Victrolas. What types of music did students enjoy listening to that?
We had quite a file of records. And most of it was classical. Otherwise, the boys played the popular stuff. Bing Crosby and that sort of thing.
You mentioned a figure before. Turn the
tape
over.
I'm going to...
Tell me a little bit about a name that keeps popping up in House Bell history, Mr. Chandler.
George A. Chandler. I met him first and got very well acquainted with him as an undergraduate because he was a member of Alpha Gamma Rho, which is my fraternity. We struck it off pretty well. I was more intimate with him than any of the other boys in the fraternity. I don't know why. Then when I came back in 30, I found out he had been quite active in the organization. Probably George Chandler was the one that helped get me appointed, now that I speak of it. He had a very good idea of what boys should do living in a fraternity or, as it was coming up the dormitories in 26. He was secretary to the secretary of the faculty. Smith was the man's name. He was up in the building on the top of the hill. Bascom. And had something to do. He had to help with the registrar, but he knew what was going on in the student organizations. And somehow or other, he was closely connected with Scott Goodnight, friendly with him, and wasn't afraid to say what he thought ought to be done. He was, I would say, fairly rigid in his social standards. So when it came to setting up the fellow program, I think he was very influential, and those things in the Badger that I referred to, have you seen them?
Yes, I have.
Well, all right, because I said I'd send you, I thought I could send you a copy. There's a very good statement about George Chandler in there, is what he did. He got the association going, and saw to it that the house units became recognized as a group, not in competition to fraternities, but filling similar services. That here's a group of men living together that should have mutual interest and interested in each other, but they have the freedom of breaking away from it. But he was very influential. Then, passing, he was the one that started me in on the Carillon committee. That's another long story. But
Mr. Wentworth is here for the annual meeting of the Caroliners. Now, here we have back in 1926-27, the Senate with Chandler as head dormitory fellow and chairman pro tem.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
What is the Senate?
That didn't last very long. They just called it I don't think we ever called it the Senate. It was the presidents of the units.
Presidents of the units.
Yeah.
Was there an organization like that when you were there?
Not Senate.
But there was one of the presidents.
Oh, yeah. The association board or something. I don't think they called it the Senate anything.
So what?
They'd meet together to handle a general program. Yeah, that Senate, you see, it was this pro tem. It was something he was getting going. See, that was the first year.
Yeah, as you've been talking for the last 10 minutes or so, thinking a lot of the word that you finally mentioned a few minutes ago, and that's fraternities. These seem to be, the houses seem to be similar in many cases.
Yeah, in too many cases, I think I'd say in too many cases, they tried to copy fraternities. They wanted to be sure to know just exactly who was going to move into the house with them. So we finally had to decree that 50% of the rooms could be assigned to returning students in the order in which they signed up. If there were more than 50%, then they had to wait until August 1st or something like that. And if the rooms were not filled by new students, primarily freshmen, then they'd assign the returning students.
When was this done?
Oh, this was probably 36, something like that.
And it was done to...
be sure that we left space for new people to come in.
So that they wouldn't become too...
And move some people out that ought to be moved out. There weren't very many, really, who lived the 4 years. There were some, but...
Was it mainly underclassmen?
No, because
50%,
but some of that 50%, if they weren't filled up with freshmen and if they weren't filled up with returning students, we'd take other juniors. And we had something about out-of-state people, and a lot of different categories that made it easy to tell somebody he couldn't live there.
it was sort of balanced in favor of Wisconsin.
Oh, yes, very much so. Yeah, very much so.
So you could take or leave out-of-state people.
Yeah. You said Senate, but it didn't meet, you didn't refer to that. I'm going to get in touch with a man who I talked with a week ago. He's in Bethesda, Maryland, and ask him if he remembers what the student organization of the presidents were. If I've forgotten the Senate, and I'll let you know.
Okay. Okay, now we are approaching 1935, and you're going to become a graduate fellow, a position that you hold until 1941. How did you become a graduate fellow? Let's start with your graduation.
This is going to sound awfully egotistical, but I think they made the graduate fellow job title in order to keep me on, because I didn't have anything else to do. It was right after the recession and so on. Things were not looking too good. And I was willing to stay and so on. But so they added this specific job of room assignment, checking on percentages and so forth. And then we had no head fellow then. Head fellow. We had a head fellow in each hall, but I was the head fellow. We had a lot of fun about that. And I kind of worked as liaison, I guess is the proper term now, to see that what the administration would like to have done. I had quite a bit of contact with Dean Fred when he was dean of the graduate school. And
What kind of contact did you have with Dean Fred?
He'd call up about people who needed special attention, housing, graduate students. Well, we didn't have any place for graduate students. Well, we'd find a place. Long story about one I won't even tell you about for the record, but I'll tell you later. Dykstra's office would call and say he'd had some politician in, hope you can take care of such and such a boy. I got into the women's hall somewhat, but not very much, because I did have the room assigning also.
What would you do when Dean Fred or President Dykstra would try to get special favors like that?
Well, they were always understanding. And I'd say, well, we can do it if we're going to be crooked, or if we have to make arrangements or something. And Dean Fred would be more persistent than Dykstra. And this one story that he'd say, well, his father's a pretty important man. There's never a politician with Dean Fred. I think we ought to find some way to take care of him. Scott Goodnight called about one, a black boy. We had a long time getting him straightened out. Didn't know he was black till he walked into the office. And we put him in as a double room with somebody else. And we had already set up the policy that a black and a white do not live together unless they mutually request it. Well, I said, we just can't give you that room. Well, I found a room for him, a very bad one. The reason it was there was because it was about the worst room in the halls. Down in a little dark place, sun never would shine in it, and so on. The mother was a teacher in the New York City school system who had graduated from here, and she wrote a hot letter to Dean Goodnight because we treated her son so meanly. He did not have he had a Scottish name, Mac somebody. No guess that he'd be black. Well, it's that sort of thing that I spent quite a bit of time on.
What happened with the black?
The father came with the boy, and he was perfectly fine about it. And the end of the semester, or before the end of the semester, somebody moved out, and we put him into a better room.
Now, let's talk for just a second about the policy. Larry Kelly talked about it a bit, the housing of blacks and whites together. Was this a consistent policy?
I left in 41, and that was before there was a problem. As far as I recall, there was one boy in Parent House, and this boy that we put in Vilas House, and we moved him into Frankenberger later. Those are the only two that I can recall we had it way up to 41.
Oh, really?
And I don't know of any girls. It was after the war that things began.
Did most of the black students live off campus then?
There were very few.
Very few. We're talking about a problem that really wasn't a problem.
After the war, yeah. It came up after the war. I can tell you a big story about Indiana housing.
Okay, Greg Goodfellow. His position has been more or less created.
It was. Yeah, and when I left, it was dropped.
Where were you situated?
The last 3 or 4 years, I lived the first year after being head fellow. I moved into the union. Lived in a room in the union and spent most of my time out here. Had an office in the refectory. And then I came back here and I had a room in the refectory till I was married. In the fall of 37, we took an apartment, but I spent my time out here. 2 or 3 years then I lived in the refectory.
What were your job responsibilities as president?
To see that things went smoothly. There was a very serious case that nowadays would have been called sexual. We had quite a time about it. Hal Bradley, the chairman of the committee, got word about it before I did. And we moved one boy out of the dormitory just right then. And the fellow of the house was severely criticized. We had quite a time. This happened the night. The next morning is when the word got to Hal Bradley. And they had that. We had that boy out of the dormitory that afternoon. And the fellow said, yeah, he knew about it, but he didn't think it was anything very bad. Well, you should have heard Hal Bradley tell him what was bad. That was about the most serious thing. Drunkenness was no problem. They'd come in, they'd be noisy, John would get them, and tell them to be quiet, and they'd get into the house. If they got in the house and got noisy, the boys would take care of them by giving them a shower. And those were different days. You cannot imagine the difference.
Yeah, I'm beginning to get an understanding after being in the project for 2 years. So your job was more or less a troubleshooter?
I took care of applications for rooms, deposits. They had to pay $10 when they sent in a deposit for a room. Took care of that sort of thing.
So the biggest part of the job in terms of being different from head fellow was the room assignment.
And the head fellow would be taking care of the two
Moved.
And over into the K. Cronstadt.
Did this job as head fellow, graduate fellow, did it change much over time, or did it mean?
Oh, I kept picking up this little thing and that little thing, okay. But then I got into the Carillon, so that took more time. I didn't lose time here with the residence halls, but I had to spend more time away from my family.
Yeah.
Christmas, and she moved in the fall of 37.
Okay, so
4 years of that.
What about the student committees? Did you work at all with them instead as graduate fellow?
No, not directly. They always had a fellow on the committee. Suppose the chairman of the committee was from La Follette. Well, the La Follette fellow would probably be on the committee. No, I just cannot emphasize it more strongly than the fellow was not the boss. He lived with them and he could counsel with them. But it was very, very rare that when a fellow had to exert any responsibility and authority. It was beautifully done. Paul Robeson spent 4 days here in the dormitory. He was there 2 days before anybody knew it. He was in Tarrant House, a black man. I don't know how they kept it so quiet. But then the night of the second day, he came up and gave us a recital.
Oh, really?
The Adams boys, the Tripp boys came down to the Adams, no, the Adams boys came up to the Tripp dining room because we had the better piano.
Paul
Robeson gave us a recital.
Something one doesn't forget.
Yeah.
Let me go to the entire housing setup for a minute now. When your graduate fell in the late 1930s, we have Don Halverson,
yeah,
who is head of housing, what's his name?
Well, he was director of residence hall.
Director of residence hall. We have the same, pretty much the same committee operating.
Yeah, right through the time.
And we have you. And now, who are the other members of the staff in housing? What are their positions?
Well, in the women's halls, of course, they had two women, Ruth Camel and a woman from Barnard College. Oh, she was quite a character. Sally. I didn't really do the room assigning. They would make up what they thought it would do, and then I'd take care of the details of it. In the food service, Beulah Daly was a remarkable person. And I've forgotten who was in the women's halls, because we didn't have much to do with that. Charlie somebody was the baker. He was a marvel. Don Halverson had a way of getting hold of people and keeping them. He got along with everybody beautifully, so far as I know, union and all, except the chief food buyer. And he was always fretting about whatever his name was.
What about any other administrative personnel like you? Anyone else working in
line? No.
So you were pretty much it, besides Don and Beulah.
Yeah.
Can you tell me anything about Ruth Campbell? Her name has come up a lot. I really don't know much about her.
Well, she was the next teacher. Came from a town in Indiana, Lebanon. I don't know how she got here, but she was in Chadburn for quite a number of years. And she did very well. She was understanding, an old maid, and so was Sarah. Sally. Sally was a character. She was in Barnard. She was quite domineering, but she got along all right with the girls, so far as I could tell. They reported primarily to the Dean of Women, and of course any problems.
That's Troxel.
Yeah, she was, Louise Troxel. Sally.
Did these, you said the girls were much more closely supervised than the boys. Was it primarily Sally?
No, it was just the custom, the social custom in those days. P- people thought that the girls here at Indiana or University of Wisconsin had so many privileges. Mine, the freshmen had to be in 8 o'clock, but the other girls could stay out till 10:30 or 11. And on Saturday night, I think they could even stay out till 12:30.
So
Friday night and Saturday night.
In terms of what was going on in other places,
yeah,
Wisconsin,
it was liberal.
More liberal.
It always had the reputation of being liberal.
Did you and you said Ruth Campbell and Sally reported being Troxel. Did you have much to do? Couldn't they have much to do with the men's, the boys' arms? See around them?
No. I had a session or two. Oh, I had several sessions with him, but he always expressed so much confidence in me that he said, we'd say, more or less say, well, I'm not going to fret about it. If there's a problem, well, you'll come to me. As far as I know, things are going all right. And Don Halverson had the same attitude. It was just too big a thing for me. I mean, it expanded my ego too much. I thought I could run things. And because of that, I realized I got cartoons in the Octopus, and there were paragraphs in the Octopus about Mother Wentworth and things like that that I deserved. It didn't bother me very much, but they were having a good time. Bill Harley, he's still around. I saw him 3 weeks ago. He used to, in the Octopus, oh, I had three or four digs, plus some cartoons. Both on the Carolyn, but on the residence halls, too. I think I have a copy I can send you.
Yeah, I might ask you.
All right.
Do you have any reflections on closing thoughts on
This is what I've always felt about the program, the University of Wisconsin, both the union and the residence halls. The residence halls became a standard of operation to which very many colleges and universities pointed their own programs because it was running so smoothly. The fellow system, they liked. I don't know anywhere else they probably have, but anywhere else they had what they called fellows. They have counselors. What's happened since the Second World War is very different than before. I'm talking about before the First World War, or Second World War. We had a very good organization of the Big Ten Residence Hall Directors that functioned pretty strongly, clear up to the opening of the Second World War. I was at Illinois at the time, and I think the last meeting we had was at Illinois before long about 42, when everybody got so busy with the enlisted men's programs, servicemen's, that we gave up the social education side of residence hall's operation. The same is true of running the union. You can't separate them really. Because the Wisconsin Union is the model, has been up until the last few years, as long as Porter Butts was there, was the model operating unit for a union in the, you know, wherever they had them. He was the director for 50 years. And of course there were criticisms, but Wisconsin with only 30 men, that was so ideal that you could have a club and make it almost a fraternity. Be careful not to make it a fraternity. We did have to emphasize that at times. The girls went along in the traditional ways, but this business of housing and putting men in houses was fairly new after the First World War. And as it came along, it was really developed here in 26.
I want to thank Mr. Norris Wentworth for being with you today. Again, this is Barry Piker, UW History Project, June 19.